Global Connections Television is a privately funded, independently produced program. The opinions expressed on Global Connections are solely those of the moderator and his guests. We invite you to go to the website at www.globalconnectionstelevision.com to view previous shows. If you are involved with a PBS or community access television station or an educational institution that has an intra-campus television hookup or perhaps a podcast or just a computer and would like to share the programs, please feel free to do so. Global Connections is provided at no cost to help people in the U.S. and worldwide better understand how international issues impact our lives.
Welcome to today's Global Connections program. I'm Bill Miller. Today we're going to focus upon a very interesting book titled Global Governance and the Emergence of Global Institutions for the 21st Century. My guest is Dr. Augusto Lopez Claros, and he is the Executive Director of the Global Governance Forum, and he is also the author of the book. Dr. Augusto Lopez Claros, welcome to today's Global Connections program.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Bill. It's a pleasure to be with you. I look forward to this conversation.
So do I. Thank you so very much. Let's do a very quick overview about a paragraph or a couple of sentences. What is the purpose of the Global Governance Forum?
There are several things that come to mind. I think we certainly want to promote research on improved or alternative models of global governance in several thematic areas, including peace and security, the environment, economic development, and the rule of law. We want to organize programs to improve dialogue and understanding among those committed to reforming existing institutions and creating new ones to build a more peaceful, prosperous, and just world. And we'd also like to assist and cooperate with like-minded civil society, business, and other organizations or initiatives to create an effective community of practice. Mm-hmm. Perhaps somewhat more ambitiously, I could add one other item, which is that we want to offer substantive and technical support to governments, multilateral organizations, the private sector, and civil society, so that we can assist them in making the right choices in the years ahead in terms of dealing with many of the very important global challenges that we face.
Exactly. And there are many, many challenges that we have today, and we're going to have even more tomorrow. And our viewers can go to your website at www.globalgovernanceforum.org to get more information. Well, what is the main theme of your book, Global Governance and the Emergence of Global Institutions for the 21st Century?
You know, the motivation for this book was actually a sense that the global order that was established in 1945 at the end of World War II at the San Francisco Conference where the UN Charter was adopted, that order is no longer working. It is not allowing us to find meaningful solutions to the many problems that we face today, like climate change, like poverty, inequality, nuclear proliferation, the arms race. And so the book is actually intended to go back to that original period in the mid-1940s and ask ourselves, what do we need to do to modernize that order, which has remained more or less frozen in time, you know? The UN Charter has never been amended. It is still the same document that was negotiated 77 years ago, and yet the world has changed dramatically. The nature of the problems that we face has changed dramatically. And so we need to modernize that infrastructure of institutions. We need to bring it into the 21st century. We need to turn the United Nations into a problem-solving organization. And the book essentially is an analysis of what are some of the challenges in that process.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the suggestions that you're making as far as modernizing the United Nations or any other international institution that needs to be brought up to date to make it a more effective and a more efficient organization?
You know that if you go back to the history, the United Nations was actually established in January 1st of 1942. Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt invited the Allies fighting against Germany and the Axis powers. And, you know, they had this sense that after victory against the Nazis, we needed to bring into being an organization that would provide for peace and security forever, so that we would never have a conflict of that magnitude and with so much killing and destruction. Now, in the early period, before the San Francisco conference, in 1942, 1943, the vision that was being discussed was actually a very ambitious one. The inspiration was the 1787 Constitutional Convention in the United States, which created a new level of government, the federal government, and gave the federal government the monopoly on the use of power and gave the federal government many other, you know, powers. And historians, I think, have agreed that that moment, the U.S. Constitutional Convention, was essentially the starting point for the United States to emerge as the most important economic and political power in the world, because it basically eliminated violence and the use of weapons at the level of the states. The federal government assumed the monopoly on the use of violence, and that created a context for peace and security and prosperity in the next, you know, couple of hundred years. So, unfortunately, that vision for the UN did not materialize. Because at some point, Roosevelt realized that he could not get the approval of the U.S. Senate, because this was an international treaty and you need two-thirds majority. And also Stalin was not particularly interested in an international organization that would make binding law on its members, right? So what we argue in the book is that because of all the unresolved problems that we have today, because of the global catastrophic risks that we face, we need to basically be more imaginative and go back to that original vision and perhaps strengthen the United Nations in some important ways. For instance, I think that it would be very good if the General Assembly operated on the basis of weighted voting. At the moment, we have a General Assembly where one country has one vote. So Nauru, with a population of 12,000 people, has the same voting power as China with a population of 1.4 billion. That makes absolutely no sense, right? The reason the UN was created with that particular characteristic was essentially to shift all the power, you know, to the Security Council. But unfortunately, today, the Security Council is completely dysfunctional, as we saw during the crisis in the Ukraine. Think Russia, a permanent member of the Security Council, can violate the most important principles of the UN Charter in the area of peace and security and still remain a member in good standing and still exercises veto power to prevent the organization from acting in the area of peace and security. That makes no sense. It undermines the credibility of the organization. So essentially, the proposals that we put forward are aimed at enhancing the credibility of the organization and making it, empowering it to actually help us find solutions to the problems that we face, rather than being an insignificant player in the world today, which unfortunately, in many ways, it is.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the two of the six organs of the United Nations, the General Assembly and the Security Council. Let me focus in on one for the moment. We may get to the other in a moment. The UN Security Council has 15 members. Five of those members are permanent, and they were basically the victors of World War II. And that was, well, the United States, then the USSR, France, the UK, and China. And so the idea was that they were going to help, they would keep peace in the world. And of course, as you mentioned, basically right after the charter was signed in San Francisco, we went into the Cold War, and the UN Security Council was certainly dysfunctional up until the late 80s, even though it did do a few things. But let me ask you, the veto, each of those five permanent members has a veto, which means they can, anyone, as we saw Russia do recently, can veto any binding resolution that comes before the Security Council. How can we get these five states to be amenable to changing that veto resolution situation? Or is there some other way to do this, to create an executive council? Or how would you rearrange or reorganize the Security Council to make it a more effective operation?
You know, in the book we have a proposal which actually is based on a precedent. The year before the San Francisco conference, that is in 1944, the members of the United Nations got together at a conference in Bretton Woods in New Hampshire to essentially redesign the global financial system. And along the way, they created the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank as the two pillars of this new system. And it's interesting, but at that conference, although we had the same players, the Soviet Union, China, you know, the five countries that you mentioned, as well as representatives from 40 some other countries, they did not opt for the veto. They actually went into a decision-making process which involved weighted voting. So the United States, being the world's largest economy, would have a greater say in the running of both organizations, and so on. And these organizations have worked reasonably well. Everybody's represented. And so in our book, we actually propose a governance structure for the United Nations that is similar to that already being used for several decades in these two organizations. So the way we would reform the Security Council is, rather than having 15 members, we would have every member to be a member of what we call the Executive Council. Every member would have a voting power that would correspond to some kind of economic indicator that reflected the size of the economy, the size of the population. You know, we can choose and discuss the indicators. Every country would have a voice. Therefore, the organization would be more representative.
There is certainly a need to reform many parts of the United Nations. You're absolutely right. After 70 plus years, there are many, many parts of it that need to be brought up to date. Well, you're watching Global Connections Television, which is a privately funded, independently produced program. The opinions expressed on Global Connections are solely those of the moderator and his guest. We'd invite our viewers to go to our website at www.globalconnectionstelevision.com to view previous programs. Also, if you're involved with a PBS or community access television station, or perhaps an educational institution that has an intra-campus television hookup, or you have a podcast, or you may just have a computer and you like our show and you would like to share it, please feel free to do so. Global Connections Television is provided at no cost as a public service to help us better understand international issues and how they impact our lives. Today, we're talking with Dr. Augusto Lopez Claros, who is the Executive Director of the Global Governance Forum, and his recent book is titled Global Governance and the Emergence of Global Institutions for the 21st Century. Dr. Lopez Claros, this whole concept is so interesting and I think so very important. One thing I do want to do now is to mention your website, in case our viewers would like to go to that. Go to www.augustolopezclados.com to read other items by Dr. Lopez Claros. Before we move off the UN General Assembly, and we'll have to do that in just a moment, and the Security Council, are you talking about all, the UN General Assembly is sort of the meeting hall of the world. Right now, there are 193 member states or countries that are members of the UN General Assembly. Basically, well, most of the countries of the world are in the UN General Assembly. So as I understand, are you saying that the Security Council would expand to 193, but would have different responsibilities? Is that correct?
Yes, the idea essentially is to give voice to every member country.
I see.
In the Security Council, which at the moment they don't, right? You have the permanent members, and then you have 10 other members who serve on the Security Council on a rotating basis, right? So at any particular moment in time, Germany, Japan, India, very large countries with large populations and big economies, you know, if they happen to be part of the 10, they actually have a voice and a vote on the debates. But if not, they may have to wait 10 years before they have a chance. This is not efficient. I think, you know, the way that the IMF and the World Bank governance structure is organized is they have a board with 24 members. Some of the bigger countries have a single chair, a single seat at the table. And then the other countries are organized in clusters.
And exactly right. And the UN is still the only international organization that brings the countries of the world together to deal with these international problems. There are regional fora that are out there, regional organizations, but the UN is still the only place where they can come together and hopefully work on these. Well, there's so many problems and so many issues that we could talk about. We could talk about nuclear weapon proliferation. We could talk weapons of mass destruction, income inequality, but all of those seem to pale to some degree in comparison to climate change or the climate crisis. This is what's really one that's really about to debilitate the world. It already is in some areas and in many respects. How would this work as far as getting these countries to work on dealing with climate change? They have come together for many UN conferences. They've made statements about they're going to support the findings of the conference, the principles of the conference, and then, to be quite honest, very little is done by a large number of these countries. And right now, a lot of scientists are saying we're into our sixth extinction. There have been five previous extinctions on this planet where the vast majority of humans, animals, plants, biodiversity, whatever, have been wiped out. How can they work? How would this work in focusing on this climate change problem and hopefully come to a solution?
Yeah, you know, I think that part of the problem that we face is that the Paris Agreement, which was negotiated in 2015, on the one hand, you know, we celebrated that agreement because it was a recognition by most countries in the world that we have a serious problem, we need to confront it, we need to do something about it, right? But then when you actually look at the letter of what was agreed, you discover that it was very flawed in design. The commitments that countries made for emissions were voluntary. There are no penalties involved for those countries which don't fulfill those commitments. And the end result has been that, as you know, emissions have continued to rise since 2015. With the exception of 2020, when we basically had economic collapse because of COVID-19, you know, every other year, including 2021 and now 2022, emissions have continued to rise. And so this temperature threshold that was established in Paris, you know, of no more than 1.5 degrees, is basically increasingly out of touch. It's not going to be achieved. The scientists are already warning, as you yourself mentioned, right? And so we need to come up with a more coercive system, a system where, you know, these commitments are binding in some way, you know, because we are all in this together. Unfortunately, the direction at the moment is not very encouraging. And I am especially perturbed by what has happened in the United States in the last few weeks. You have had two important developments, both of which are very perturbing for what the United States can do in the area of climate change. First, you had the Supreme Court essentially taking away from the Environmental Protection Agency the ability to regulate emissions. And then, of course, you had last week the US Senate essentially killing President Biden's attempts to address climate change through a variety of different initiatives. And if the United States is in denial as a nation, as a political entity about climate change, then it cannot play the role of an exemplar, right? It cannot go around the world preaching and telling other countries to get their act together on climate change because they themselves are not doing that. And so this has implications that are systemic. They go well beyond what is actually going to happen in the United States, which is not very pretty. It's very perturbing. I think the US is going to enter into a period of, you know, great dislocation and suffering for the population because of the inability of the government to come together, you know, and recognize this as a problem which requires, you know, all the political parties to working together. But it will have international ramifications as well, because without the leadership of the United States, other countries will basically say, well, if the US is not doing it, you know, maybe we can afford to wait until 2050. And so it is potentially very, very problematic, right? And in our book, we say, give the United Nations some limited powers to actually manage the global environment in a way that is binding on, and obligatory on its member countries. It seems to me it's the only way. Otherwise, ad hocery and leaving it to countries to do it on a voluntary basis is not going to work. It is not working. It has already not been working for many, many years, and there is no reason to believe that it will work in the future. And so it is, you are absolutely right. This is the most important serious challenge that we face. It is a risk to our future and the future of our children. And the sooner we get our act together, the better.
And it's going to get worse and worse. And the irony of this whole thing is that so many of these climate change deniers are saying, well, we can't afford to lose these jobs. We cannot afford this. We can't afford that. This is going to cost us. It's already costing us far more. As we see the fires raging in California or in France and Spain, we see the desertification taking place around the globe in many countries. The River Po in Italy is drying up. You've got Miami. Miami on a clear day can have a foot of water in some of the streets in Miami because the ocean's coming in. And that's going to, at some point, destroy your aquifer. This is going to cost trillions of dollars just to deal with it. And not overcome it, but just to make sure that the oceans don't encroach upon the cities or flood the subways. And it's a tragic situation. And if we could just get off these fossil fuels more quickly and to get to more clean energy, that would help at least abate some of the problem. Do you find this the case all around the world?
I think that some countries are doing better than others. I think the European Union is leading the way in terms of taking climate change seriously and doing what needs to be done. But they are only one player, right? You cannot solve climate change without the cooperation of China, without the cooperation of the United States, because those are the two largest emitters of emissions. You know? I find it very perturbing that the politicians are basically so focused on the short term. You know, in August of 2019, the scientists did a very interesting experiment. They wanted to know how much water is melting from Greenland, you know, into the ocean, right? And they actually calculated the amount of water that would melt over a two-week period. This is the summertime, all right? So temperatures were a little bit above normal, although Greenland is cold most of the year. And it turns out that over a two-week period, enough water melts in the summertime from Greenland into the ocean to cover the entire state of Florida in 7 feet of water, right? So, you know, sea level rise is going to become a reality sooner rather than later. And you mentioned, you know, Miami being flooded on perfectly sunny days and so on. We're going to see more and more of that. And it is regrettable that the politicians, you know, will not begin to act until basically they have, you know, water under their chins, you know.
You're absolutely right. You're exactly right. The house has to be burning before they call the fire department. That's exactly what is happening. Well, the book that you have written is really, really outstanding. And we really need to focus on your book, Global Governance and the Emergence of Global Institutions for the 21st century, because so many of these situations are getting worse. And to compound the problem, as you mentioned about the Supreme Court decision in the United States, which was a total disaster, we have a dysfunctional Senate, which is almost as much of a disaster as the Supreme Court decisions have been recently. So it is really a horrific situation. But in our last 30 seconds, what message do you have for our viewers and for the people of the world to help us deal with this situation?
You know, even though some of the comments that I made today would appear to be a little pessimistic, I am actually a long-term optimist for humanity. As we face the future, we have two choices. Either we're going to make conscious choices that are going to be respectful of science and human life and that are going to strengthen international cooperation, and we're going to begin to deal with some of these problems on a systemic way, or we will do that in any case, but we will do that after a great deal of suffering and dislocation, and after, you know, we have seen, as you yourself put it, you know, half of the house burned, right? My fervent hope is that we will not take the second path, which is destructive and painful and will bring a great deal of suffering to mankind, but that rather we will have enlightened leadership, we will have politicians that are focused on the long term interests of humanity, not just the next congressional election in the United States.
And it would be very helpful if the politicians in the U.S. and in many other places around the world would stop politicizing issues and start working on them, because they're not going away and they're going to be even worse tomorrow than they are today. But Dr. Augusto Lopez Clados, I want to thank you so very much for a very interesting and a very informative program.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure. Thank you. I'm Bill Miller. Thank you for joining us today on Global Connections Television.